Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting and video streaming live from New York City, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme, America's Deep State. We're going to examine in depth on this special broadcast what it means to not know what our government is thinking or doing on our behalf. My guest will include Ray McGovern from Northern Virginia. Ray McGovern served as an Army intelligence officer and a CIA analyst under the seven presidential administrations, from John F. Kennedy's White House to that of George H.W. Bush. Among his duties was preparing the president's daily brief, which was one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's most senior national security advisors. He was responsible for the analysis of Soviet intelligence regarding Vietnam. Since retiring from government service, he has been one of our nation's most vocal peace activists and journalists. In 2003, he helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsely used to justify war on Iraq. Ray McGovern's opinion pieces appear in many leading publications. He is also the author of an important section in a book, Neoconned Again, Dealing with America's War in Iraq. He holds degrees in theology and philosophy from Fordham University and is a graduate of Harvard Business School and also Georgetown University. His website is raymcgovern.com. He will be our first panelist. Then we'll be speaking with Peter Van Buren from Virginia. Peter Van Buren served with the Foreign Service for 23 years. He received a Meritorious Honor Award for assistance to Americans following the Hanshin earthquake and in Japan, and a Superior Honor Award for helping an American rape victim in Japan. Another award for work in the tsunami relief efforts in Thailand. He worked in Taiwan, Japan, Korea, United Kingdom, and Hong Kong. He volunteered for Iraq service and was assigned as a Provincial Reconstruction Team member 2009-2010. Van Buren worked extensively with the military while overseeing evacuation planning in Japan and Korea. He also was at Camp Lejeune, and he was on the Hill in the Department of State's Congressional Liaison Office. He is the author of We Meant Well, more recently the life novel The Ghost of Tom Joad, The Story of the 99%. It's like a postmodern Grapes of Wrath. And his website is wemeanwell.com. Then we will have Colleen Rowley. Colleen is a former FBI special agent who was with the agency for 24 years, from 1990 to 2003. She was the chief division counsel operating out of Minneapolis. In May of 2002, she blew the whistle and later testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee about the FBI's pre-9/11 failures to track and investigate, a leading element within the 9/11 conspiracy. She also stepped down from her legal position with the agency in 2004 after her unsuccessful issuance of warnings about the dangers of invading Iraq. In 2002, Colleen was selected by Time Magazine as one of the three Persons of the Year award. She ran for Congress to represent Minnesota's 2nd District on the Democrat Farm Labor Party. Last month, she went to Moscow, along with other whistleblowers, to present the Sam Adams Award for Integrity Intelligence to Edward Snowden. Her website is ColleenRowley.com. And our final panelist today will be Dr. David McMichael. Dr. McMichael is a former CIA analyst who was an expert in counterinsurgency in Southeast Asia. He also served as an analyst for the National Intelligence Council. Dr. McDaniel resigned publicly from the agency in response to the Reagan administration's policies in Central Asia. He was a key witness in the Nicaragua versus the United States case held before the International Court of Justice, which ruled that the U.S. violated international laws by supporting the Contras as well as mining Nicaragua's harbors. He also testified before Congress and the Senate about the consequences of the Valerie Plame affair. He is a member of the Veterans Intelligence Professional for Sanity, co-founded by Ray McGovern, is a founding member of the Association for National Security Alumni and the Association for Responsible Dissent. He has a master's and doctorate in history from the University of Oregon. That's our lineup. It's going to be an extended program today. Let us begin with Ray McGovern. Nice to have you with us today, Ray.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be with you.
Ray, there's a lot of confusion in people's minds about what's going on in the Ukraine, the truth of what's going on, the misinformation from mainstream media about what Putin is doing and not doing, and then the complete lack of openness from the White House, Congress, and the media regarding U.S.-backed fascist and neo-Nazi parties who orchestrated the coup against the former president. Not too long ago, Obama and Putin were cooperating against Israel's wishes on Syria and Iran in order to avoid an escalation of a full Western military involvement. Today, the White House's foreign policy agenda towards Russia is completely the opposite. We know that based upon public words from Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, one of Hillary Clinton's appointees, that the White House has been planning a regime change in Ukraine since Obama took office 5 years ago, and has spent more than $5 billion tax dollars on this. So the primary question begin would be to, for you and others who look for the truth in a different way, who have the ability and have been historically charged with examining issues to find the truth, then give us a briefing as if we, the American public, were sitting in on those White House briefings that you led under seven administrations to tell us what you know is the likely motivations, why are we there, who benefits, who doesn't benefit, what's the agenda. The forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary. It goes back to the falling apart of the Soviet Union and what would become of the two military blocs that existed at the time, the Warsaw Pact, which was the Soviet Union and the East European countries, and NATO, which, of course, was the U.S., Canada, and the West European countries. When the Berlin Wall fell in November of 1989, you could tell that the rest of East Europe was about to crumble. And the main question, of course, was what would the Russians do? Now, we know what they were used to doing. We saw that in Hungary in 1956, and we saw it in Czechoslovakia in 1968. And most people don't realize, Gary, that the Russians had 24 divisions, highly mechanized divisions, in East Germany at the time. That comes to about 350,000 men, okay? So the question was, would the Russians suppress the dissent in East Germany and the rest of Eastern Europe in the wake of the fall of the Berlin Wall? Now, President George H.W. Bush was perspicacious enough to realize that this was a big win for us, but it didn't have to be a zero-sum game. He immediately told Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the Soviet party leader in those days, he said, look, let's get together and talk about this. So we see things changing all too rapidly. There are dangers of escalation. So they met on the Isle of Malta in December of 1989. And Bush, to his credit, said, look, Mikhail, we're not going to dance all over the Berlin Wall or what's left of it. We're not going to take undue advantage of you and all these troubles, but in return for which, we don't want you to use those 24 divisions in East Germany to suppress what's going on. Now, Gorbachev said, that makes sense. All right, that's the makings of a deal. Let's get together with your Secretary of State and our Foreign Secretary there, the Shevardnadze was his name. He was a very close colleague of Gorbachev. Long story short, 2 months later, February 1990, they got together in Moscow, and the deal was, all right, not only will Russia pull out its 24 divisions from Eastern Germany, but Russia will tolerate the incorporation of East Germany into West Germany. Now, when you consider the Russians lost about 25 million people in World War II, you can imagine what a bitter pill that was to swallow, Gary. But Gorbachev swallowed it. He said, as long as you prevent it from getting a nuclear weapon, it's okay. The two Germanys can be reunited. And in return for that, here's the deal. You are not to leapfrog over East Germany. You are not to move NATO one inch eastward toward our frontiers. Jim Baker said, it's a deal. And it was a deal. The only thing lacking was no one wrote it down. Okay. Now, and my dad's a lawyer, and he says to me very frequently, Ray, get it in writing. Always get it in writing. He didn't get it in writing. So, fast forward a couple of years, Bill Clinton's in office, and he wants to show how tough he is on defense. And so a couple of East European countries, some former East European countries, say, tell us that they'd like to join NATO. And Bill Clinton, hey, that's good. You know, we can kind of be really forward-looking and tough on defense. So let's incorporate them into NATO. And somebody said, well, there was a deal, way back with under George H.W. Bush, and we promised not to do that. And Clinton said, okay, well, where is it? Show me it on paper. And Clinton said, it wasn't on paper. And I have to say, Bill Clinton was no gentleman. Gentlemen's agreements didn't mean nothing. It didn't mean anything to him, at least in those days. And so 12 former East European and Baltic countries were incorporated into NATO, moving NATO eastward toward the Russian border. Now, the next two subjects, the next two nations that were in line to join NATO were Georgia, out in the Transcaucasus, and Ukraine. And this was getting pretty dicey because Georgia's under the soft underbelly of Russia. And Ukraine, of course, is hard up against the Russian border, has always been a very, very close territory for the Russians. So what happened was this, and this is new, Gary. I dug this cable out of a WikiLeaks trove. WikiLeaks, of course, got it from Bradley Manning, but it speaks volumes, and I'd like to cite just a few details from it. It's classified confidential, but that's okay. We have clearances right here, right? Anyhow, the subject is, Niet means Niet. Russia's NATO enlargement red lines, okay? Who's it from? It's from Ambassador Bill Burns. He's number two in the State Department right now. And the date of it is the 1st of February, 2008. So we're fast forwarding now from the year 1990 to 2008. And what's happened in the interim? Well, the Soviet Union, I'm sorry, not the Soviet Union, but Russia has sort of gotten its act together. It's become a relatively powerful country, not as powerful as before, but able to defend its interests. So here's this cable from Moscow. The number, if you want to look it up, is 265. 1st of February from Moscow to Secretary of State immediate. That's a fast way to send it. With info copies to Secretary of Defense, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they don't say it right here on the info line, but also Bradley Manning in Baghdad. Now, why do I say that? Well, because the mechanism there, once you send it to the Joint Chiefs and Secretary of Defense, the Defense Department had very little cognizance of how difficult or how sensitive these cables could be. So, long story short, Bradley Manning got a copy of it, and that's why I have a copy right in my hand here. Let me just read you part of the summary. Again, the subject is Niet means Niet. Russia says no to NATO enlargement. Here's Bill Burns, the ambassador. The muted first reaction to Ukraine's intent to seek a NATO membership action plan at the Bucharest summit, which is going to happen 2 months later. Now, after that, Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and other senior officials have reiterated their strong opposition, stressing that Russia would view further escalation, expansion toward the east, as a military threat. NATO enlargement, particularly to the Ukraine, remains an emotional and neuralgic issue for Russia, and strategic policy considerations also underlie strong opposition to NATO membership for the Ukraine. In Ukraine, these include fears that the issue could potentially split the country in two, leading to violence or even some claim civil war, which would force Russia to decide whether to intervene. Okay, that's the end of the summary. I won't read any more. But you get the message. So this is February of 2008. Now, Bill Burns warns Washington that "niet" means "niet," and he finishes up with a little comment here, probably worth reading. He says, "While Russian opposition to the first round of NATO enlargement in the mid-90s was strong, Russia now feels itself able and willing to respond more forcefully to what it perceives actions contrary to its national interests," William Burns, ambassador. Now, what's my big point about 1 February 08 and the date of this cable? Well, 2 months later, in Bucharest, on the 3rd of April, 2008, the heads of state of NATO declared, "We will accept Ukraine and Georgia as members of NATO." Now, not subjunctive, that was a declarative sentence, and that was 2008. Now it's, 6 years later, and the warning that Bill Burns put in his cable, "niet" means "yet," wasn't heeded because we felt like we're the sole remaining superpower in the world, and we could endanger, as Russians look at it, endanger their national interests by moving NATO up to and include Ukraine. Why? That's the big question. Why? There's no national defense considerations here. The whole name of the game was to enlarge the economic sphere of the EU and our own economic interests, to get them under the IMF austerity plans. You know, the whole deal, like Greece is being subjected to now, get cheap labor and get the multinationals pretty much in control of the economy, to include Ukraine. And the Russians just are not going to allow that. And so when, as you pointed out before, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, was on the Maidan, on the Independence Square in Ukraine, giving out cookies and encouraging the putschists to start this revolution on February 22nd, the neo-Nazis and the fascists all joined in, and they deposed the duly elected government of the Ukraine. As perverse and as corrupt as it was duly elected. They could have waited 1 year for the next election, but no, they took it over, and the person that Nuland mentioned in that intercepted telephone conversation with the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, his name was Yats. She said, "Yats is our guy." Full name, Yatsenyuk, but she didn't take the trouble to know how to pronounce his last name, I suppose, but he was our guy, and we're going to put him in. He knows about the central bank. He headed it up. He knows what's necessary to satisfy the IMF and the Wall Street bankers. He's willing to do political suicide by doing the kind of austerity measures that are necessary. So he's our guy. The other guys can wait in the wings, but Yats is our guy. It's right on YouTube. Okay, they put it on YouTube. And 4 weeks later, what happens, Gary? But they have this putsch, this coup d'etat in Kiev. As I say, the shock troops, the troopers were the Nazis, neo-Nazis, and fascists. And they took over, and who becomes the interim prime minister? Yatsenyuk. I wrote an article at the time, the subject was, "Yikes, it's Yats." So that's the story. Now, what the so-called pro-Russian separatists are doing out in the eastern part of the Ukraine is not much more nor less than saying, "We don't accept that coup. We don't expect this coup regime. We don't respect it, and we don't think they'll honor our wishes. We don't want to be subservient to the EU the same way as the Greeks and others are to do this austerity. So we don't want to supply cheap labor to the conglomerates. And we don't want Monsanto in here. We don't want all the kinds of stuff that they have planned for us. And so we're not gonna stand still for it. And over the weekend, as you probably know, they had two referendums in Luhansk and Donetsk in the eastern part of Ukraine. Incredible turnout. It was a little messy because some people hadn't been registered and let people vote simply with their passports rather than a registration stamp. But it turned out, you know, as expected, over 80, some places over 90% in favor of some kind of independence, some kind of autonomy, some kind of separation from the coup leaders in Kiev. And where does it stand? Well, a couple of those places have appealed to join Russia, and Russia has very deftly sidestepped those appeals and is calling for talks between the coup regime in Kiev and the eastern Ukrainian leaders, such as they are, who have expressed their disapproval and some of them taken over government buildings. And what the Putin has called for is not only these talks, but a cessation of the offensive by Ukrainian government troops, spearheaded by some of these neo-Nazi and fascist militias, to get them to stop trying to exert their will over these places in the eastern Ukraine, where it's pretty much declared regional autonomy. The response that has happened after Putin not only initially tried to discourage the referendums from taking place, but also called for talks between East and Western Ukrainian leaders. The response from the Kiev authorities has been to drive the army still farther east to try to put down what they see or what they imagine as a rebellion without any quarter. And that's the problem. The Russians seem willing to step back and say, look, we're not going to join parts of the eastern Ukraine to Russia right now. We think we can work this thing out together, but what has to happen is talks at the highest level between the Kiev authorities, as they put it, and the people in the eastern Ukraine. Now, the Kiev authorities, who are actually taking advice from the likes of Victoria Nuland, are saying, heck no. We've got this army, and we're going to put down this rebellion in the east. And so the elections that are supposed to be held actually on the 25th of May, which is 2.5 weeks from now, are very much in doubt because many of the East Ukrainian leaders say that they're not going to take part in any kind of phase. Yeah. I'm sorry?
No, yeah. I was taking a look here at the timeline. Here's what I'm confused by. Maybe you could help enlighten me on this. Finland borders Russia, and Finland, for some, is a model that could be emulated for an independent Ukraine, independent of both Russia and American economic and military influence, and autonomous enough to construct its own path of sovereignty. And Finland is not a member of NATO, yet it has excellent relations with both superpowers and Europe. And on the social and economic indexes of nations, Finland is among the most prosperous nations in the world with a social and educational fabric that puts U.S. to shame. So I'm interested why no one in the media is even discussing that as a model. Also, I do not see the mainstream media doing what would simply be logical and reasonable. Why NATO, in every interview, and I just saw this the other day on CNN, why it is being allowed to be unchallenged in what its history has been, why we even need it, and what is the relationship of NATO to securing a world of peace or creating conflict. They're not bringing up, for example, what was predicted by many people, you and myself and others, about what would likely be the outcome in Libya, it was worse than anyone predicted, that they've taken no responsibility, nor this administration, nor the neocons. And then on a separate level, you have months before the coup, corporations such as Monsanto and Cargill and a major U.S. oil company had made huge investments in Ukraine to establish private facilities. And for many observers, such as myself, the coup has been one that opened the Ukraine to Western economic colonization. Do you believe there's any legitimacy to that, that there might be a primary impetus behind the U.S. economic and military interest in bringing Ukraine into the fold of Western Europe, but to bring it in where it is under the model, such as Greece, of an economic sanctions that literally creates serfdom in the population, taking away pensions, firing mass amounts of people, and reallocating the money that it does have or the money that it will receive into select hands of those in power and their bureaucracies and their interests, but not a penny would go to improve the quality of life for the average person in the Ukraine. None of this is being discussed at all. Would you touch upon those topics for a brief period of time?
Sure. You're right on target, Gary. Finland, first of all, is an obvious model. We raised that model in our very first commentary after the coup d'etat in Kiev. As you say, Finland disavows any intention to join a military bloc, whether it's NATO or any other bloc, and is no threat to Russian interests, is careful to abide by what it perceives as the national interests of Russia, and is one of the most prosperous countries in Europe. So that is the obvious example. What the extra element here with respect to Ukraine is would be a regional autonomy, which between the pro-Western West and the pro-East or pro-Russian East would have to work things out. But it's not like that's an intractable problem, because the polls all show that the East and West Ukrainians would like to be part of the Ukraine. They just don't want to be subsumed under the kind of regime that you just described, which really approaches economic serfdom at the whim of the IMF. So, yeah, that's the general idea, to intimidate the Russians and to wean away the economic richness of Ukraine. And Ukraine is not it's not on its back. It is because of mismanagement and corruption, but it's got the black earth, it's got industrialization in the back that does need renewal, but it's there. They've got natural resources, so it's not a basket case by any chance. It's out of money because of the corruption of the leaders that took over since the Ukraine became independent. Now, what about that $5 billion? Victoria Nuland has bragged about investing $5 billion into Ukrainian pro-Western aspirations. There used to be ways to check on what kind of monies the U.S. government is putting out here and there. I would like very much to find out who authorized that $5 billion, where it went, how much of it went to the National Endowment for Democracy, which is now in the business of regime change, taking the mantle of the CIA mid-80s or so. And so, it's so obvious, but your main point, I think, and my main point, is that the normal American will not learn any of this because it's not in the mainstream media. NATO is never mentioned. Let's discuss that for a second. Why NATO? NATO was set up when the Russians came into Eastern Europe after World War II. Now, Russia had been invaded a number of times, World War I, World War II, lots of other times, Napoleon and all the rest of it. So whether one approves of their taking over countries in Eastern Europe, I think that some people could understand it, particularly since right away NATO was born, and we, of course, had more money. We were not on our back from the war, and before you know it, we had two opposed military blocs, the Warsaw Pact and NATO. Now, what happened when the Berlin Wall fell? What happened when the East European countries were allowed to be independent And those 24 divisions from the Soviet Red Army were pulled back into Russia and were disbanded. Well, what happened was NATO persisted and the Warsaw Pact desisted and fell apart. And so one would have thought, well, you know, if we're serious about peace, and Gary, this is really important. In my lifetime, I've seen a couple of real good chances for real peace on a wide scale, and this was one of them. This was one of them. Gorbachev, the head of the Soviet Union, then Russia, he was a serious guy. He had already tried to convince Ronald Reagan to ban all nuclear missiles, okay? Now, that didn't fly because, we won't go into that. But what Gorbachev was interested in was a kind of a peaceful solution to all this, where the Russians would be included in the Europe from Spain, from Portugal, all the way to the Urals and beyond. And after George H. W. Bush left office, Bill Clinton came in, the smart guys, Dick Cheney first and foremost, who was around for a while in that early period, they wanted to dismember the Soviet Union. They didn't want any part of letting Russia prosper. And so, as a result of all that, NATO not only didn't fold its 10 like Arabs and silently steal away, NATO enlarged. It became twice its size. It moved to the east despite the promise. In other words, in the Bronx we say, you can welch on a promise. We welched big time, and we did not include the Russians in all of this. So the antipathy that existed during the Cold War gradually built up, and when the Russians saw that we were also going to build an anti-ballistic missile system in Poland and the Czech Republic, and they said, well, what's that for? We're not going to shoot missiles at you. Oh, it's for the Iranian threat. Well, look at the globe, for Pete's sake, and then look at the intelligence community's projections on the Iranian threat. The intelligence community says, and this is important, that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed to work on a nuclear weapon. So missiles of that kind are no good without nuclear weapons, so why would you want to build an anti-ballistic missile system in Eastern Europe, the Czech Republic, and Poland? Well, two reasons. Because the anti-missile ballistic missiles system is the largest corporate welfare program ever existing in the United States. Billions and tens of billions of dollars have been wasted on this project since Ronald Reagan, where all the reputable scientists say it can't work. It will always be able to be defeated, no matter how sophisticated. Of course, the tests showed the tests never can hit all the decoys or anything like that. So that's number one. Number two, it's to intimidate the Russians. Say, look, you know, if you ever have the inclination or a temptation or anything to do bad things to the West, well, you know, we can not only defend ourselves, but we will be instantly retaliating. It's old school. It's Cold War thinking. But that's what it counts for, the enlargement of NATO and the intimidation or attempted intimidation of Russia. And now they're up against the Putin. You know, I drew that little timeline here from 1990 and then 2008, when finally, after those 18 years, Russia was back on its feet. He says, no, yet means yet. And yet, our leaders, such as they were in those days, said, well, you know, tell me about yet. We can do what we want because we are the sole remaining superpower in the world. We're the sole exceptional, or as Obama says, we're the only indispensable country in the world. And Gary, if I know my old antonyms and synonyms from grammar school, the antonym for indispensable is dispensable, and that means that by definition all of the countries, including Russia, in our view, are dispensable as far as U.S. strategic concerns are involved.
I appreciate that in-depth answer. We're up to the end of this segment, but I do want to ask a very brief answer to this one. In the last 5 years, I've seen over 200,000 settled lawsuits, many between corporations in the pharmaceutical industry, on Wall Street, in the different energy sectors, where people have conspired. And, for example, one example only, when a large pharmaceutical company gave one drug over a four-year period that cost 60,000 deaths, but it, during the court proceedings, it was shown that they had known that they were giving us a bad drug, but they also knew that the cost of settling the suit would be small compared to their profit, and they were correct. We also saw that one of the largest banks in the world was money laundering for drug cartels, over $800 billion. They paid a $900 million settlement, under 1% of what they actually made, didn't have to give any of the other money back. Nobody went to jail. Well, they pled guilty recently, and yet, with all these proven cases, including Wall Street insider deals, the moment you mention that we have conspiracies proven that we can show, it's as if the media closes down on you. Even the left, even station programs on Pacifica, where I've been for 38 years, and MSNBC and NPR, you're now considered kryptonite. And where you might have been given a form at one time, not so easy for people who have something legitimate to say, including, let's say, yourselves, all of you, plus Chris Hedges and others. And yet they mock it. I actually heard once Keith Urban, Rachel Maddow, mocking the idea of, you know, they're not going to do any show on, you know, conspiracies. And I'm thinking, well, take a look. We have a lot of proven cases, proven by settlements and testimony. So it's not as if we live in a country that there's no conspiracy. There are conspiracies in a lot of different areas, including the National Security Agency spying on Americans. That was a conspiracy. The FISA, going against FISA, that was a conspiracy. So ones that we can prove, and one where there is substantial evidence, shouldn't we at least have the courage as a nation to have forums, open up dialogues, and have those who have evidence that's compelling to be able to bring them without being denigrated as they are now in this society? Final short thoughts.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I'd have to say that the sea change that I've seen in 52 years here in Washington, you see a lot of change in those that kind of period. But the fact that we no longer have in any real sense a free media is really big. And that's why alternative media shows like your own, Gary, websites that publish the truth are at such a premium. So it comes to the point where a lot of us are trying to intimidate, for example, intelligence professionals now. We're not supposed to talk about anything that we could have learned from a leak. Well, this is really, really, really bizarre. And I think that they're afraid. And what we need to do is face up to the fact that we need to give them something to be afraid about. We need to get out in the street. We need to protest in the manner of people who went before us. Now, against that, we have things like the National Defense Authorization Act, which for the first time in our country's history allows Washington to use the U.S. military to suppress dissent inside this country. That's big. How did it come about? Occupy. Occupy seemed to be taking off. The means for repressing it seem to be not quite up to it. Here in Washington, the question became, what happens if these 5,000 demonstrators grow to 50,000? And suppose they surround Congress and we can't go back to our Georgetown penthouses for martinis in the afternoon. Who are we going to call on? Call on Park Police. No, Park Police are sympathizing with the demonstrators. How about, the Capitol Police. Capitol Police only good for checking those machines so you don't bring a gun in. Oh, I know the district, well, district police know that they're part of the 99%. Oh, how about the Secret Service? Secret Service, well, if the ones that aren't in playing it up in Cartagena, you know, there aren't enough of them anyway. And so what are we going to do? what we're going to do is reverse at least a century of law and allow the Washington to use the army, the U.S. Army, to suppress dissent. That's the only reliable instrument. We have a poverty draft. We have people who do what they're told. We'll bring them in and make sure that the likes of McGovern and the rest of them are just wrapped up, even though they're peacefully demonstrating, and we'll put them away. Oh, he can't do that under the law. Oh, yes, he can. Read the fine print. We can put McGovern and anybody else away indefinite. Well, I don't want to exaggerate here. Not indefinitely. Only until there are no more terrorists in the world, okay? And we can put them in Guantanamo or any place we choose to put them. It's all legal. It's called the National Defense Authorization Act. And that's the kind of thing that we have to get out in the streets and protest against, because that deprives us of all the freedoms that those very gutsy Virginians and people from Massachusetts and elsewhere all fought real hard and risked their lives, their treasures, and their sacred honor to defend. So you're right. This is very, very important. And the press is the main culprit here, because there's no, even if there was a Tom Paine around, he wouldn't get any, you might interview him, Gary, but nobody else would. And so we have to figure out how to be clever enough to beat this, to use the alternative media, the fifth estate, what I call the web. It's no small deal that we do have a fifth estate, with the fourth estate having imploded. And we just have to use our minds and be as clever as those that would like to suppress the freedoms that, as I say, our forefathers fought so hard to give us, and who realized even then that they would be vulnerable if we didn't stick up for them. Right now, that's precisely what we need to do.
I appreciate those insights. I just hope that there comes a time when the average American stops what they're doing for a moment, the kind of mindless distraction with the reality shows, and ask a simple question. Are they going to look deeper into these issues so they can try to find a truth? For my last thought on this is, just think of who we've been supporting up to this point in the Ukraine. Think of the powers in Kiev. Think of the ones who pledged themselves to the Nazi legacy of Stefan Bandera's reform of the Nazi Ukrainian Galicia SS, which was directly responsible for the slaughter of countless Jews and Gypsies and Soviet Russians. This is a very dangerous moral game the U.S. government is playing that can only come back at some point as blowback, when we realize, you mean we were supporting these racist neo-fascist groups? We were arming them? We were giving them technical and information, intelligent information? Yes. Why didn't we learn about that? And because I don't know if we're ready as a country for that kind of truth, because it would challenge many of the other preconceptions of an open, transparent, and a democratic government. So I thank you, Ray McGovern, for going out there, getting yourself in the line of dissents to take your place, and because I don't see, with maybe a rare exception, of all the people who call themselves advocates for democracy, when was the last time you saw them putting themselves in a place to be arrested, to actively protesting, to inviting their audience to join them in these protests? I don't see it. I wished I did. If we did have those people, then we could start getting more people in the mainstream conscious of this.
You know, Gary, just a brief word here. I think one of the main problems is this typical aversion of Americans to undertake any significant activity without there being a pretty much an assurance of success. This isn't in these perilous circumstances. This isn't about success. This is about faithfulness. This is about doing the good thing because it's good. And whatever happens to it is often beyond our reach, but we need to sow these seeds. And we can always be surprised by the subsequent generations, as long as they have models to look to and say, well, all right, they risked a lot, just as our founders risked a lot. The least we can do is stand up to these rights.
My personal feeling, Ray, I don't know of a single signer of the Declaration of Independence that would not be on today an enemy's watch list, that would not be considered a suspect because of the rhetoric, their alignment against those in power. That's unfortunate. That's my own subjective opinion. Thank you very much, Ray McGovern, for being with us. I appreciate it. Now let's shift gears and go to Peter Van Buren. Peter has served, as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, as a Foreign Service service personnel for over 23 years. And he is the author of We Meant Well, and more recently, the real-life novel, The Ghost of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%, kind of like a postmodern Grapes of Wrath that looks at the economy. His website, wementwell.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be back, Gary. Thank you for having me, and thank you for having Ray McGovern on. I'm lucky enough to count Ray as a friend and a mentor and someone for all of us to look up to.
Oh, great. We're not going to limit our audience. We're doing an extended edition today, so it's longer than our normal program because I didn't want to limit any of the panelists when they have something important to say. Now, you are an expert in Iraq and the Middle East, and we have not, and Colleen has written extensively about Syria, mm-hmm. and David has written about Eastern Europe and specializing on Latin America also, and the coups that we have back there, especially in Venezuela, and the policies in Thailand, which are unfolding right now as we speak. But what I'd like to do is have you take a look at the issues that are important to you, that you know about, that we can benefit from. And as I told Ray at the beginning, Ray, this whole program today is about a topic that is receiving no attention, America's deep state. Deep state, meaning behind the headlines and behind the policymakers, the politicians, the members of the judiciary and the executive and legislative branch, there is still another group think. There's still another group of people who have influence. And we never hear about these people. We're never invited to give our opinion about what we should be doing until after we're well into it. And then we're not asked our opinion. We're propagandized into that opinion. So having worked in the State Department and during your tour in Iraq while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, to what degree do you see Ms. Clinton's signature on what is unfolding in Ukraine and between the U.S. and Russia at this moment? And for example, did Hillary Clinton appoint the neocon Victoria Nuland to be the deputy for Eastern Europe? And then during your career at State, describe to us how its foreign policy agenda has evolved and changed over the years, and to what outcome is that likely to be?
The issues you raise are very, very important, Gary, and Secretary Clinton's influence continues at the Department of State. Victoria Nuland was her press secretary, and as I'm sure your listeners understand, the press secretary enjoys a very close personal relationship with her principal, in this case Hillary Clinton. The press secretary needs to know exactly what really happened, and therefore sits in on all the important decisions and meetings, and then translate that into the way it's going to be pushed out to the public. What will be said, what will not be said, and how the actual decisions and events will be spun and manipulated for the public. It's a position that requires that personal relationship, and it requires an extraordinary amount of trust between Hillary Clinton, in this case, and Victoria Nuland. It's not something you stumble into. And the rewards, of course, for doing that job well, as I'm sure Ms. Clinton thought Victoria Nuland did, are another position, another assignment that puts you even further up the scale and puts you deeper into the decision-making process. And so Victoria Nuland did step from her role as press secretary into her role as assistant secretary for European Affairs. And right now, there is nothing more important in that office than what's going on in the Ukraine. I think we need to take one more step backwards, however, and remember that Victoria Nuland came out of the neocon cluster that fueled the Bush administration and that sent us catapulting into Iraq and Afghanistan and the whole so-called war of terror. The folks that make these terrible foreign policy mistakes don't seem to go away. They seem to just recycle themselves and show up again a couple of years later, an administration later, to continue to do the bad things that they did earlier, make the same mistakes over and over. And I think while there's a bit of that that can be subscribed to basic sort of ignorance and government silliness, if you will, there's more going on than that. You don't send people who make mistakes back into the fray unless either you don't think they're mistakes or you're comfortable with those errors. And that's what I think we're seeing in the Ukraine. Secretary Clinton's influence, of course, extends far past her tenure because there's very hard to find anybody in Washington, D.C. That does not believe Hillary Clinton will be the next president of the United States. And as such, she is a force to be reckoned with, someone to suck up to, if you will, someone to keep on your good side. And so it's very difficult to imagine anyone in Washington, and particularly in the State Department, now not being influenced by Hillary Clinton, either directly by carrying out her old policies, even though there's a new guy in the office, or by watching the tea leaves, if you will, listening very carefully to what she's got to say about international issues, both publicly and, of course, privately, and keeping a close track of that. A lot of people who worked with her at the State Department got their fingers crossed that they will be anointed upward into the White House after she takes office, and they're certainly not going to do anything in the interim that might affect that. This is another version of the deep state, perhaps in some arguments less nefarious than what my friend Ray McGovern was describing. Perhaps even more old-fashioned, cronyism and this type of thing is as old as Washington itself. I think the stakes have been raised, given the amount of power that the United States has still militarily and economically, and especially given what's happened to the use of that power since 9/11, where even the rudimentary checks and balances that might have been in place, the War Powers Act, the willingness of Congress at some point to stir out of its sleep and say no to the president, things like that, those have all gone away. And the president has become, and this is both Bush and Obama, has become much freer to act independently, both with the traditional tools of the broader military and the new tools of the NSA surveillance state, and things like the Joint Special Operations Command that basically has become the president's own Praetorian Guard, his own little military within the military that can be sent out to conduct special missions, assassinations, stuff that nobody will ever even hear about unless something accidentally goes wrong. Those capabilities were not available to previous presidents, but they grew under George Bush, and the Obama administration has embrace them with gusto and enthusiasm as robustly as they have anything else. You add that all up, and it speaks to a very concerning future for America and certainly for what happens to other countries under our thumb.
Thank you for that answer. A follow-up question for you, Peter. Under the Clinton State Department, WikiLeaks released documents showing that virtually all of the ambassadors and the high-ranking officials at the UN were to be monitored and spied upon, even very strange and bizarre notions of getting their DNA. Mm-hmm. And then letters appeared showing that Clinton was sending messages to European and Southeast Asian countries saying, we expect you to take genetically engineered organisms, meaning seeds. And it wasn't that we're asking you to do this. There was the implied threat that there would be consequences if they didn't. Now, this was at a time when the science of the safety of GMOs was being debated, and that there were multiple studies showing that there were gross concerns. In fact, the most famous, called the Seralini study, where the French scientists and a whole group of scientists using the same model rats found that as long as a rat lived longer than 3 months, suddenly all these abnormalities occurred, including tumors. And then you looked at all the science and all the other studies from the GMO companies, their study stopped at 3 months. So then you think, well, this couldn't be by coincidence. You mean all of the different companies ended their studies at 3 months because we found nothing wrong? And yet this one guy lets it go for the full length of the rat, and suddenly all these tumors start to appear. And then a Scottish scientist for the European Union did the same thing. And then there started to be a debate. Should we allow genetically engineered food? And what happens to the native culture, their seeds? And because these GMO foods are frequently terminator seeds, meaning you grow them once, you cannot grow them again. Well, if you're a poor indigenous farmer, you survive by taking your tomato seeds, your corn seeds, your maize seeds, and you dry it and you keep it for the next year. This you couldn't do.
Sure.
And so, in effect, our State Department was at its highest level, possibly unbeknownst to others within the State Department, but it was working at the behest of the special multinational pro-globalist agenda. And I thought, isn't it interesting? We have suspected this, but now we have absolute proof of it. And yet the American media did not pick up on this and go anywhere near this issue, either at the UN spying on our so-called allies. And then finally, our State Department surely would have known about the spying on the heads of other governments. Suddenly everybody was just surprised. And no one asked the basic question. The New York Times did not ask us. The Washington Post did not ask us. None of the networks. What moral right do we have to assume that we, the United States, and we alone, should be able to spy on any citizen in the world, any ruler of any country, no matter how democratically elected, at our choosing and to the degree we want, to collect information with no consequence? No one asked that question.
No.
Instead, the issue was Merkel angry? Well, yes, she's angry, but they're still allies. That's not the issue. I don't care if she's angry or not. I care what gave us the legal authority, the moral authority, to feel that we could transcend any boundary. So I'm not even seeing the right questions being raised, and I don't believe that's by accident. Could you address these issues, please?
Gary, I think you've tapped into the underlying sludge that informs so much of what is going on in our country now, and that is the part of America whose job it is to talk about government, to let the people understand what government does, right and wrong, has given up. The press, the Congress, the founders established a free press. They put it right there in the First Amendment. Not the 12th Amendment or the 20th Amendment, right there on as you open the book, if you will, that a free press is an important part of our democracy. Thomas Jefferson said that an informed citizenry is critical to a democracy. Well, that begs the question, of course, of who is to do the informing. Jefferson and the others understood that government inherently will not be as open as the people require. Humans are humans, and therefore you needed another force, if you will, another player, another influence on this, and that was to be the press. Though the history is checkered, and there have been good and bad times and things, throughout our history there have been people in the press who have done their job. Sometimes it took a little help. Men like Daniel Ellsberg and Ray McGovern, and more recently Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, needed to kind of nudge the media a little bit here and there, provide them with the information they were unable or afraid to access. But we've seen in the last 10 or 12 years, and basically since 9/11, a degradation in whatever the media was capable of doing and willing to do, into a point where most of the mainstream media is nothing but stenographers for the government, and the mainstream media, in collaboration with the government, does everything they can to marginalize or push aside non-mainstream media. Oh, that's just a blog. Oh, that book was self-published. Oh, it's an internet show. Things like that, which ignore the content, ignore what's being said, don't judge these things by their validity, what they say, but instead try to dismiss them simply based on the medium or the technology, if you will, that they choose to use. That keeps people from listening to shows like this. It keeps people from, quote, taking blogs seriously, unquote. It means that if one of the major publishers did not put out your book, you won't see a review in the New York Times. You won't get the exposure you need. And then at the same time, we see the rise of what I call the pseudo alternative media. And these are shows like The Daily Show or Colbert or any of their imitators, which purport to be alternative sources of information. But if you listen carefully, if you parse it all out, you're not hearing much new, maybe some snarky remarks rather than the usual fawning admiration that you might get up the mainstream media. They'll make a joke or two and maybe call somebody out for something extraordinarily silly. But in terms of providing new information and particularly insights into what's really going on, they're just there as kind of a smokescreen to give people the illusion that they're understanding things. I can give you an example in talking about my new book, The Ghosts of Tom Joad, which is a story of what's happened in American society and in economy over the last 50 years. We have a shorthand phrase for it now, just calling it the 99%. And while the number may not be completely accurate as we stand here today, it's heading in that direction, and it's already pretty darn close. That story, because I have found, is extraordinarily difficult to tell because you run into these walls of misdirection and smokescreens. You talk about food stamps, and your audience will oftentimes say, well, only lazy people get food stamps. No, actually 72% of the people who receive food stamps are working, many of them far more hours than what used to be considered full-time, because they can't get 40 hours at Walmart, so they have to do 30 hours at Walmart and 20 hours at Target and another 10 hours at a fast food restaurant to try to put together a living. You get stories thrown at you that, well, if workers would just retrain, then they could go out and get better jobs. And they're lazy or they're stupid. And then you ask yourself, well, you know, the number of unemployed factory workers right now is the equivalent of all the undergrads in university in the United States. And if we're going to find jobs for all of those people, where are all these retrained factory workers going to work? The training is simply going to create trained unemployed people as opposed to trained employed people, because training doesn't create jobs. Jobs create the need for training. Go out there and ask people who are studying, who are English majors or something like that, that doesn't immediately translate into a job the way engineering or medical school would. It's jobs that create the need for these training programs. But yet, it's easy to marginalize people, and the media does this all the time. Oh, occupies a bunch of kids who don't know any better, and they're all unemployed, so they've got free time, and the same old tired tropes that we heard in the 60s and the 70s about hippies and people who were afraid to go to Vietnam, so they were protesting it to save their own skins and all that. I'm sure you're familiar with all those things, and certainly many of your listeners are. For the younger people in the audience, it's a Google away to see how the same arguments were employed, and that was a joke, employed against unemployed people throughout history, and against people who today join Occupy or Code Pink or support Manning or Snowden and are marginalized and dismissed as hippies or losers or unemployed or too young to really know, or pick your favorite terms. It's really quite a shame.
There's a gentleman in the other room, and I'm going to find out his name from my engineer in a second, because as I walk in the studio, this tall fella from Sweden, and he's just visiting here, and he said, I told all my friends back in Sweden that I would come by. We are a bunch of professionals, engineers, architects, lawyers. We listen every day. We download your shows, especially the Progressive Commentary Hour. All right, I got a question. How many people on MSNBC have people in Sweden downloading their shows, listening, talking together because it empowers them? So you see, the mistake people make, Peter, is they assume that there's only one reality, one truth, the official one, and that all others are relegated to insignificance and cast aside. And I'm saying that we are not a few people We are tens of millions. The fact that we have yet to be organized, the fact that we have yet to do as much as we can. But take a look at Vermont. Last week, Vermont signed the only law in the United States saying we do not want any genetically engineered food unless it's labeled. The first to do so, Maine is behind that, Connecticut's behind that, and other states are lining up to join on for that. Was all grassroots. That was not personality driven. That was information driven. Now, are you sitting at your computer still?
I am.
Okay. What are the two most famous documentaries you've ever heard of?
Documentaries?
They both won Academy Awards. Yeah, documentaries.
Oh, boy.
Al Gore, An Inconvenient Truth, right?
Okay.
Type in An Inconvenient Truth, the movie. So it's specific. Otherwise, search engines will look for each word.
Okay.
And then, of course, you're ranked on Google depending upon where you stand in that stage.
Okay.
And just take a look. Tell us what number comes up with An Inconvenient Truth, the movie.
I get 191,000.
Okay, good. That's not bad. Now, mm-hmm. Michael Moore. Take any one of Michael Moore's films.
Okay. Bowling. I liked...
What'd you like?
I liked Bowling for Columbine.
Then let's... Bowling for Columbine, the movie.
And that, you get 20,000.
20,000. Not bad. Now my latest film that has never been released, that has never been in a movie theater on television.
Okay.
Seeds of Death, the movie.
Seeds?
Of Death.
Of Death.
The movie.
The movie.
Mm-hmm. It's about genetically engineered foods, Monsanto.
And as I typed it in, Google completed it for me, and I get 26 million hits.
Okay, not bad.
Not
Mind
bad.
You, never released, not in any movie theaters, not on television, but 26 million just people. Now, Google down, do you see that it's number one on every single page? Just Google down the page. You'll see it's every
mm-hmm.
single listing. Now,
yes.
Now the film that that we went after the FDA and our pharmaceutical industry called The War on Health, the movie. The War on Health, the movie.
That brings in 209 million results.
209 million results. Mind you, we're not talking about war and health, which would be a general search of those words. The War on Health, the movie. And if you Google down, you'll see that every single entry for about nine pages is that movie. So that's the majority of that. So
wow.
Here we have a reality check. And I showed this guy from the network. I said, you haven't seen these films. You didn't know they existed. But guess how many other people do know about these films and are using these as movements to empower you. So those whistleblowers, those who've had the courage to come forward, those people who have been maligned, those people who have been depressed, those people who feel they are at the bottom end of anything happening because there's no recognition, you are recognized, Peter, and Peter Van Buren, and others, and you are recognized, Colleen Rowley, and you are recognized, Dr. David McMichael. You are recognized, you're respected. There are people paying attention to you, not in the New York Times, not in the Washington Post, not on Fox or any of these others, but they are not the ultimate truth, but they have control over the official political truth, but not all of it. And that's, I just wanted to show that, and this only came about because you made a comment, and I'm just responding to it. So, Peter, that's a little different reality than what you might have thought, right?
It's very much a different reality, and very much an empowering one, and a reality that should make all of us understand that we have a job to do here, and that we can reach people when it's important to do that.
Well, we publish almost 80 articles a day from Progressive Minds. Today it was on Chris Hedges and a lot of others. Stay on the line, Peter. Let me go over now and say, first of all, thank you very much for being on, Colleen, and for your patience in listening to the other panelists up to this moment.
Thank you.
Colleen, are you there? Hi, Colleen.
Hello? Yes, I am.
Hi, Colleen. Thank you very much for being with us and for your patience in listening.
Yes, it was great to hear Ray McGovern and Peter Van Buren. I agree 100% with what they said.
Colleen, we're going to give us an insight and an education that the mainstream media refuses to discuss, but we need it from you. And that is, we have been given half-truths and full lies concerning Syria. And we'll just use that as one example because I know that you're very familiar with that. We have been led to believe that this was all about the tyranny of the existing regime, and that anyone fighting was a freedom fighter, much like Ronald Reagan showed us that the Contras were freedom fighter in Nicaragua, and that we should support these freedom fighters clandestinely in any way we could. Tell us the truth of the story we have not been told about Syria, regime change, and the impact that we have had on that country and its citizens.
Well, first of all, let me mention that the issues and the situation in Syria are very much related to that in Ukraine, because, of course, the thing that connects them is that, quote-unquote, Putin and Russia are the enemy. And you will find that this is almost the MO in the FBI. We used to say modus operandi. It's the motivating factor. It's a standard thing, which is to demonize, the leader of the country that you want to topple or that you want to have regime change in. And even Putin in Russia, I mean, is I think on the list. I mean, maybe further down, but there have been people who have publicly said, you know, we actually want to topple Russia's regime. And so the people that have sided with the Syrian opposition have actually begun to demonize Putin. They'll claim that Russia and Iran are helping the Syrian rebels, and so therefore they are also the enemy. I just saw on Facebook last night this banner, and it's on the Arab Americans for Democracy, quote-unquote. And the Arab Americans for Democracy, of course, all of their postings are about the Syrian opposition and various, a lot of propaganda, that is always the case in war. And this banner, though, on the front says, "Ukrainian brothers, stand up to Putin in Russia." And so there is a very much a link between the situation in Syria and the situation in Ukraine. And it's because, unfortunately, I hate to even recognize this, but this old Cold War where people are either with us or against us, and that we now have to choose sides, and the side that the United States now says it's confronting is Russia and Iran and Syria, perhaps even Iraq. I mean, everybody who's an obstacle seems to be one of the enemies. And, of course, NATO is the ally. But the truth is that, and Israel, of course, that's the other big ally. But the truth is, the United States is actually spying on everyone, allies and citizens alike, as much as enemies. And it's kind of hard to realize where this is all going to lead. Why is this push for a new Cold War, heaven help us if it doesn't turn into a hot war, because there's been a horrible number of deaths in the Ukraine already. And Syria, was close. And that's what you asked me about with Syria. Well, last fall in September, we were this close to launching war. We found out later, Seymour Hersh just published an article, and one of the big revelations in his article, some of which come from military sources, is that it wasn't to be a limited bombing, as they said, limited bombing to quote-unquote punish Assad for having crossed this red line and using chemical weapons. This, again, is all conjecture because they didn't really have any evidence, but this is what they said, and this wasn't to be a limited bombing. This was to be for regime change, and it was to be a massive strike. What I've found here, and I'm located in Minnesota, right in the middle of the country where, people would think that we have more common sense. There's always this idea of Minnesota nice and that people in Iowa and Minnesota have more common sense. Unfortunately, we even have large segment of our peace community in Minnesota misled by so-called progressives like Keith Ellison and Al Franken, both of whom went out in front when Obama said, you know, you've violated my red line and we're going to bomb Syria, Keith Ellison and Al Franken both went out shilling for war on Syria. And unfortunately, a number of people in Minnesota then have fallen in league with this. And so we sit there every day trying to, exactly as you were saying, trying to point out the truth. To this day, now, if your rationale for bombing Syria truly was this use of chemical weapons back on August 21st, there really was not evidence. There was nothing solid, as Kerry said. Kerry said that there was undeniable evidence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. These were his exact quotes at the time. And then later there was a little bit of a fallback. Well, it's not exactly undeniable evidence, but it's common sense evidence. But the truth was there was never really any evidence for who was responsible. Yes, there was an attack, and it actually was identified as sarin. That's true. But who was responsible for that attack? Could it have been some of the rebel groups, which are actually terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, and even worse, there's even worse groups than Al-Nusra now, jihadists that have been sent to fight through Syria, through Saudi Arabia in Syria. And so, no, our media, as we've been talking about, our media never even mentions that possibility. And it took Seymour Hersh a few months later to find out that there actually was a defense intelligence paper, a paper that actually said that some of the rebel groups were able to produce sarin. It's quite a hard, difficult process to do that. And so the common analysts will say, well, no, it has to have come from Syrian supplies, sarin, because it's just too hard to produce in quantities, etc. But no, there is actually a defense paper now that said months before the attack that some of the rebel groups, either working through Turkey or other countries, have been able to get the precursor chemicals, etc., and produce these weapons. I don't think we know at this point. I still don't think we really know who was responsible. But that's not the point. The point was we came this close. We came within, and within days of launching another war on a poor, war-weary American public. As Ray said, we have the poverty draft, so people think this is a job creation thing to have more wars, etc. But we came this close, and it was based on nothing, nothing more, even worse, I think, than the lead-up to Iraq, which was, of course, as we now know, completely falsified and completely exaggerated as to Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. So I continue to write about it, and you find out that people like Keith Ellison in Minnesota, he's by the way, you know, you were talking about the word progressive, and I've kind of said, you know, well, we ought to do one of two things. Maybe Keith Ellison ought to be criticized, and he is the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus. But he's actually become a warmonger. He not only shilled for war on Syria, but he actually shilled for war in Libya before that. And so, you know, I'm trying to, you know, in the sense that, you know, the truth-telling thing, I knew Keith Ellison. I considered him a friend. He was against the Iraq war. And when I ran for Congress in 2006, he actually stood on the Capitol steps with me after I and a state senator whose son died in Iraq had come back from Cindy Sheehan's encampment next to Bush's ranch, and Keith Ellison stood with us, and he was a anti-war firebrand. And then all of a sudden, these years later, when he's, you know, obtained some power in Congress, he's turned pro-war. And it's a pretty, of course, it's disgusting, and it's like, you know, completely unprincipled, but you wonder how this can happen. Anyway, I think that we all need to do our best. As Ray said, it's not about the results, but we do need to do our best to tell the truth. And in some cases, that does mean pointing out these inconvenient truths about our elected leaders.
Thank you for that, Colleen. And by the way, I don't consider Al Franken or some of these people progressives at all. They might use the term, but they haven't done anything and sustained that effort to show they are. And But more significant to this issue, some have suggested that there are operatives at work in high positions, possibly from our intelligence services, such as the CIA, the FBI, Homeland Security, the National Security Agency, and possibly some fractions in the Department of Defense, the State Department, and the Justice Department, in association with other agencies, that have power to make policy without first consulting with Congress, without sharing their thoughts with the American people. And this is part of this whole deep state. Could you address your knowledge of any of these activities? And have you seen proof that these individuals or groups exist and are in effect working outside of the challenges of our system of transparency?
I'm going to kind of piggyback on something Peter Van Buren said, which is, I think that the sycophant nature of people, and he was talking about how many people now see Hillary Clinton as the next president, and that because of that, then they are trying to curry favor. And I think that the neocon and neolib contingents are still very much in power. Bob Perry on Consortium News writes all the time about the neocons, and I'll just go back to Minnesota. I noticed about 3-4 weeks ago, we had Condi Rice come speak here about 4 weeks ago, April 19th. She gave a talk. She was paid $150,000 by a private corporate foundation at the University of Minnesota to give a talk on civil rights, if you can believe this. The talk was about the anniversary of the civil rights, and of course her talk wasn't even at all about that, because she herself personally was not a part of the civil rights movement, etc. So in any event, we protested Condi Rice. Well, then when you start looking at who they're bringing in as speakers, the week after Condi Rice, they brought in Elliot Abrams. The very famous neocon, Elliot Abrams. 1 week later, one week before Condi Rice. Then, I'm looking again, and I see the same entity, with this private corporation of, Carlson Foundation, along with our Humphrey Institute, and I see that they're having this big forum, a whole, day-long forum, on democracy promotion. And guess who's the sponsor of this forum? National Endowment for Democracy. Their speakers were Robert Zoellick, a former World Bank official, and Fukuyama, who was one of the signers of the Project for the New American Century. And actually, three of the major participants in this day-long were signers of the Project for the New American Century, which proposed that there would be a whole list of countries in the Mideast that the United States would either topple or invade and have war with. And so you see those three names, Fukuyama, Zoellick, and then we have a former Republican representative, Vin Weber, who was a signer of the Project for the New American Century. And he's an official in the Humphrey Institute. Then the crowning thing is I see who the money man is here, the money sponsor, which is this Carlson Foundation. Marilyn Carlson sits on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy. Now you can't imagine when you start to see all these names come into place and you see how this is working. And this is at the University of Minnesota, for heaven's sakes. So this is how insidious this is, and the neocons and or the neolibs, which are, I don't know what the difference is, to be honest, the National Endowment for Democracy probably is a softer power. They try to go in and do these things through journalists and through, sponsoring insurgent groups and through human rights groups, etc. And so they work, then the neocons are actually the hard power. They'll say, this isn't working, we have to bomb them. And so I think that, the American people, this is hardly exposed in the mainstream media, but these are the powers of the deep state, the neocon and the neolib. Now, your agencies, your intelligence agencies, your 16 or 17 intelligence agencies, I think are largely sycophants. And many of the Haydens and George Tenets and the people who rise up through those agencies who are looking to become directors, Keith Alexander, I mean, all the people, they want to curry favor with the people that they see in power. And I know there are people who believe that the neocons have, after Iraq especially, that they, were out of power because they were so abysmally wrong. And people think, oh, they've been wrong. They're no longer in power. That is, Victoria Nuland's a prime example. She is married to Robert Kagan, who is the founder of the Project for the New American Century. William Crystal, has taken the Project for the New American Century and given it a new name, the Foreign Policy Initiative, but he has now accumulated a whole group of these neocons. And, you know, it's still very powerful, and I think it is driving our government.
I appreciate those insights, Colleen. And by the way, Colleen is a former FBI special agent who was with the agency for 24 years and also for a number of those years was the chief division counsel operating out of Minneapolis. I believe in the one comment you made about Abrams, Elliot Abrams, I think that he was pardoned by George Bush, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. I don't know if you can still call him a felon after their pardon. I guess not. You can't.
No, you can't. No. Once they've been found. Please hold your thoughts because I want to get to my final panelist here, and he has indeed contributed so much over the years. Dr. David McMichael, a former CIA analyst, an expert in counterinsurgency in Southeast Asia, served as an analyst for the National Intelligence Council. Very important work he's presented. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Gary. I hope I have something to add after this amazing amount of information that poured forth from your three previous guests.
I don't question that you're going to have more than enough because I'm asking you about South America specifically. I'm asking you about what has happened in Venezuela. I'm asking you what we've done currently in Thailand. Because we don't look, the American media does not look at, was America in any way complicit behind the scenes in regime change? And as a result, it's almost all the neocons creating the talking points that, well, if the people wanted this kind of democracy anymore, this liberalization, they would keep these people in office. They don't want this. And I'm saying you're not seeing the whole picture. Pull back and look at the context. Would you please pull back this curtain for us and show us what's actually been going on historically in South America and what and why we should be extremely cautious about trusting what the media says in an unchallenged way about America bringing democracy to these countries?
Well, that's a very old story, and it goes back, of course, to the 1823 with the proclamation of the Monroe Doctrine during the period of the Latin American Wars of Liberation from Spanish rule, in which the U.S. took the position that they would not allow European countries to come back in and restore or take over any of the newly independent Latin American areas, which is over the years translated into the Western Hemisphere is our backyard. And we do what we want there, and if any governments come to power which attempt to stake an independent path or, in fact, to be disobedient to the United States, they will be punished. And the preferable means of punishment, at least in the post-World War II era, has been to use our intelligence agencies, so-called, to carry out, as they say in the region, golpes de Estado, coup d'etats. And this, of course, leads to the antique. If that's how old it is, it's an antique joke, which is told in Latin America. So why are there no golpes in Washington, D.C.? And the response is, because there is no U.S. Embassy in Washington, D.C. So this has been American policy to do this, and most recently expressed, of course, in the response, and you mentioned Ronald Reagan and his preference for so-called freedom fighters, the attempt to suppress by force of arms the revolution in Nicaragua, the so-called Sandinista, suppose the Sandinista revolution, which tried to establish a more economically just society and provide more assistance to the people in that poor country, which had been several times occupied by United States Marines in the 1920s and even before. And so this led to the emergence of Elliot Abrams, among other people, and the so-called Iran-Contra affair, which occurred because after a lot of public outcry and pressure during the 1980s against the U.S. Support for this armed intervention in Nicaragua, staged from Honduras and with the support of the Honduran, I'll call it a military dictatorship there, was intended to make life so bleeping miserable for the people of Nicaragua that they would not any longer support the government. And I was an international observer to both national elections in Nicaragua during the 1980s. And in the first election, despite the efforts of the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a terrible term for what it actually is. And it's, by the way, one of the leaders and directors of the NAD is our former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, at the moment. And the member organizations of the NAD, by the way, are the international relations branches of the Democratic and Republican parties, of the AFL-CIO and its capacity from the American Institute for Free Labor Development, and another weird term, and other working member is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Now, this National Endowment for Democracy is allegedly a non-governmental organization. However, it is almost entirely funded by the United States government, and I think, if I am correct and close to it, the last year's appropriation to support these quote-unquote non-governmental activities of theirs was in excess of $40 million of dollars. So it gets a lot of first-class plane travel for some of the people from these organizations, and they are able to spread the money around. And as you know, in politics, money talks, and it talks very loudly in the United States, and in some smaller countries, even much more loudly. So that's one of the things that Colleen, in particular, was referring to. So it's in a certain sense, it's a cover for a political form of quote unquote covert operations. And covert operations, by the way, got an official legal definition in the National Defense Appropriation Act of 1993. And I can, just off the top of my head, quote that clause almost exactly. And that is that covert operations are activities undertaken by the United States government or one of its branches to control or influence political, economic, or military events in another country, which are carried out in such a manner that the participation of the United States is concealed, or, if revealed, and here's the great phrase, can plausibly be denied. So that's where that is, and that's been a part of U.S. activity in Latin America for a very long time. We used to be, of course, much more open about it, and the so-called banana wars carried out by my old organization, the U.S. Marine Corps, throughout the 1920s and 30s, not only in especially in Nicaragua, but also in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, which we occupied from 1916 to 1924. And at that time, under the guidance and support of the liberal icon president, Woodrow Wilson, who was motivated as much as anything else in his conduct of policy in the Caribbean by his firm belief as a good native South Carolinian that colored people, as he called them, were incapable of governing themselves.
Wow. We have to check Ancestry.com to see if he was related to Mr. Sterling. Take us back for a moment, Dr. McMichael, to Nicaragua. We have a lot of younger people listening who may not have been born then or be aware. And even to older people, let's refresh their memory, because we keep hearing about the Reagan years and the miracle that he performed and how he made us all stable. And there's an entirely different story there. And I think both Iran-Contra is a good example, but also Nicaragua is an example.
Yeah, well, Nicaragua has an extraordinarily interesting history with the United States. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons for that is re-emerging at the present time with the project now undergoing under the current government of Nicaragua with the Chinese People's Republic, in which the idea is to construct an alternative to the Panama Canal, which will run through Nicaragua. And in the center of Nicaragua, there's this enormous lake, Lake Managua, and then go out to the Atlantic side. Now, this was the original preferred site for the transoceanic, the Atlantic Pacific Canal. And as a matter of fact, the man brought in to supervise the project, this is back in the 1890s, was the designer and builder of the Suez Canal, French engineer. As it happened, there had just been a revolution in Colombia, in which the United States took a very strong part, and the at that time, what is today the Republic of Panama, was a province of Colombia. And in return for its support to the Colombian Revolutionary Government, this was one of these periodic insane revolutions that have emerged in Panama, in which many scores of thousands of people were killed. I don't go into detail about why these things happened, but they typically were more political than involving anything socially or economically important. It was just as who was going to control the goods. But in any event, the result of this was that Panama emerged, and since this new Panamanian republic was entirely in the hands of the United States, important elements in the U.S. Said, "Well, why should there be a canal through Nicaragua, which we don't control? Why don't we build one through Panama?" And the result of this that was helped very greatly by the fact that there was, right about that time, 1890s, an enormous earthquake in Nicaragua, which periodically has them, as don't we all, and the Nicaraguan government had issued postage stamps showing the volcanic eruption. And the pro-Panama Canal forces in the United States and working with the Congress hurriedly distributed pictures, these accounts, and the postage stamps to all members of Congress to say, we cannot support building a canal through Nicaragua because look at this, it's seismically unstable. And therefore, Panama should get the canal, which it did. And, of course, the arrangements made with the new government of Panama, who's representative, by the way, in dealing with the United States on this, was a Frenchman who had been the designer of the Suez Canal. But that besides, it established the canal zone. It effectively made this newly snatched little republic. Colombia sent a group of troops, a force of troops, into Panama to try to prevent this, and the United States landed its forces, Marines and sailors from landing forces, which both were militarily more effective and were able successfully to bribe the Colombian military leaders and get them out of there. But the result was the establishment of the canal zone, the building of the Panama Canal, a huge public affairs success for the United States, which once again demonstrated our true domination of Latin America. We go back, you know, as I say, the at that time, for a variety of reasons, Nicaragua had been subject to a series of internal armed movements and so forth. And in the position taken in the early 20th century and emphasized, I may say, during the Woodrow Wilson administration, the United States sent its forces, the United States Marines, in the so-called Banana Wars, into these countries which were experiencing these. And in the case of Nicaragua, they met unexpected and long-lasting resistance from a local named Sandino. And he refused to surrender to bribery or to assassination attempts and maintained a fairly effective resistance for a period of quite a number of years, and was finally killed. And when the United States did withdraw, it set up its and during the occupation, we had formed a quote-unquote National Guard, and we found a convenient leader of that National Guard, and he became the president of Nicaragua and maintained his presidency for many, many years until in the 1970s, he too was overthrown and an independent government formed with the support of this group who called themselves, on Sandino's model, the Sandinistas. This, in the aftermath of the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion against Cuba, was declared by very frightened, or allegedly frightened, people in the United States, a Russian-supported movement to establish a beachhead on America's shores, only 1,900 miles from the Texas border. Think of that. So we mounted a considerable operation against these Sandinistas, who were showing themselves to be very popular, had a good support throughout the different areas in the world. François Mitterrand's wife, the Premier of France's wife, was a very vocal supporter of that, and France and Mexico both recognized the Sandinista government, which we eventually did as well. But in any case, getting back to the NED, by this time, let me put it this way, the justification for the U.S. support for this so-called Contra organization, which was made up of members of the former National Guard who had been recruited and with the backing and also backing and support of the then Argentine military dictatorship, were brought to various places, many of them in Florida, trained and transported down to the Nicaraguan border in Honduras and began this long series of military operations. Now, this was rationalized in the United States government by the outspoken declaration of the Reagan administration that the Sandinista military was only able to act against these patriotic freedom fighters, as Ronald Reagan called them, raiding in from on Honduras and to a certain extent from Costa Rica as well, I may say, that because they were receiving, because the Salvadoran rebels in El Salvador where a anti-government movement was ongoing, the and continued throughout the 1980s, an extraordinary struggle, that the reason we had to act against Nicaragua was because Nicaragua was receiving weapons, military equipment from Cuba, and then smuggling it across the border into El Salvador to give to the rebels. Now, at that time, I had been asked in 1980, just at the time William Casey became director of the CIA, and just at the beginning of the Reagan administration, because of work I had done in Southeast Asia, in Thailand, by the way, for the better part of 4 years during the Vietnam War, on where I was attached to the U.S. Embassy's Office of Special Assistance for Counterinsurgency, I was asked by my former boss and very ranking CIA guy, I can give his name, Pierre de Silva, he wrote a book about his wife, but the CIA just set up a new estimates office in which they wanted to bring in outsiders, non-career people with a certain amount of experience and background to take charge of writing national intelligence estimates. I don't explain the interior politics of that for you, but I was asked to join that office, and because of my background, I had written my doctoral dissertation years before on the U.S. relations with the Dominican Republic over a long period of time. And so I was asked to come in and take charge of the estimates writing on the Western Hemisphere. And, of course, the big focus at the time was the war, I can call it that, against the first the revolutionary and a little later the elected government of Nicaragua, headed by the Sandinistas.
Unfortunately, Dr. Michael, we are out of time. Just to conclude here, we know the outcome. And for those of us who study this history, that Ronald Reagan's and the neocons' Contras, the so-called founding father equivalent people, were really a terrorist. And they transported weapons and lots of money in return we made sure that a lot of those planes coming back into the United States, including in Mena, Arkansas, were loaded with drugs. The CIA never took credit for that, even though Gary Webb, a great reporter, would later break a story on that. And that would all be kind of washed aside by the government. I want to thank you very much, Dr. David McMichael, Colleen Rowley, Peter Van Buren. I want to thank all of you and Ray McGovern for being on to share your insights, profound and deep insights, onto America's deep state. We opened a door. That's all we could in this period of time. I thank you very much for listening. I'm Gary Nall.